The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking are not necessarily the views of this station, its affiliates, sponsors, or advertisers.
Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is. Cause we're Skeptically Speaking.
Hello and welcome to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Shell. On today's episode, we'll be taking a critical look at what science tells us about gender. Think the research is clear-cut? Think again. Our feature interview is with academic psychologist Dr. Cordelia Fine. Her new book is Delusions of Gender: How Our Minds, Society, and Neurosexism Create Difference. Before we get to our interviews, I have a shout-out to our friends in Waterloo, Ontario. They're holding a Drinking Skeptically Saturday, October 16th at 7:30 p.m. at the Barley Works in Hother Hotel at 59 King Street North. If you listen to this show, there is a better-than-average chance that you'll like the people that you meet at Drinking Skeptically. Check out the show notes for links. First up today, let's talk to our lovely resident evolutionary biologist, Greg Layden, for another installment of Everything You Know Is Sort of Wrong. Welcome back, Greg.
Thanks very much.
So today we're examining another in your collection of falsehoods. Now, for any new listeners, what does that mean, that term?
I like to use the term falsehood specifically to mean an idea usually having to do with evolution or evolutionary biology or human behavior or something that may actually be something that lots of people believe. It may be something that's even partly true, but somehow when examining it, it reveals some kind of misunderstanding or warped understanding of biology or of evolution. And by examining the falsehood, we can just come to a better understanding of how things really work.
So today's falsehood is that modern hobbies are an evolutionary consequence of prehistoric gender roles.
Right.
So that's the commonly held belief, that since men have historically been hunters, it evolutionary follows that now they would enjoy fishing and football and such.
Right. Okay. Exactly.
And similarly, women who were in charge of finding edible plants and making sure that their families didn't die of poisonous ones have evolved to enjoy shopping. That's the theory.
Exactly. And it may be true. It's possible that our modern Western gender roles and the way that we see each other in terms of gender are somehow influenced by our evolutionary past. It's quite possible, because we are an evolved species. We're not exceptional. Our physiology and our phenotypes generally have evolved, and probably our behaviors have evolved as well. So it's not an absurd idea to think that there might be some evolutionary background to our current behaviors. The problem is that the belief we mostly have, that we've come to accept because we hear it so often and are told it so often, is that our genes determine our behaviors, and our genes were molded and shaped in this Stone Age past in a very specific, relatively narrowly defined set of ways that are manifest in our current culture and our current world in a certain way because of that past, which says a lot about how our behaviors come to be. It assumes that we're very, very much genetically programmed, and that nothing after the Stone Age influences our genetics or our evolution or our behaviors in any way, and that we don't adapt to the current situation. Rather, we misadapt because we're trying to be hunters and gatherers, and we end up instead going to football games or having bake sales.
So maybe explain how that theory would work evolutionarily.
The basic idea here, and I should just say first, there's several different sources of this kind of received knowledge about gender roles. Going back to classic Victorian writings, and you can read this even in Darwin and a lot of the biologists of their times. I mean, Darwin talked about his theory of sexual selection involved the idea that females had an innate sense of aesthetics. I'm talking about female birds and female mammals and female everything had an innate sense of aesthetics that males were driven to adapt to by having bright plumage. And that's kind of a weird Victorian kind of notion. Freudian thinking, early 20th century thinking about morality and intelligence and sexuality, what's normal, is a gendered concept. Margaret Mead and people debating against Margaret Mead, anthropological questions about our affect, nurturing females, violent males, empathetic females, and so on. And then later, really in the 1970s and 80s, it became vogue for psychologists to carry out numerous experiments on sex differences, and that really related more to abilities, things that could be tested in labs, math abilities, special vocabulary abilities, linguistic or language-related abilities, and so on. And so you see constantly now girls score higher on this test, boys score higher on that test. That's the kind of differences we're talking about. The most cohesive theory that has emerged to explain this is probably the one called evolutionary psychology, which is a very explicit theory. That's what's nice about it. It's very testable and coherent internally. And the idea is that there's this thing called the environment of evolutionary adaptiveness, which is the period of time over which a trait emerges and evolves because natural selection is working a certain way for an extended period of time, and the trait is shaped by this selection. And the human EEA, environment of evolutionary adaptiveness, is the Pleistocene, which is a period of time that's about 2 billion years long or so, during which time humans, like modern-day hunter-gatherers in southern Africa, which have been heavily studied to sort of understand the human past, lived in groups of about 30 and foraged, hunted, and gathered in a certain landscape where food is dispersed widely, and men hunted, women gathered, and so on. And this shaped our brains to be good at certain things. And specifically, this theory states that our brains actually have evolved, genetically programmed, more or less, modules, things that are actually called modules. They're little functionalities in our brain. Like we have a module that lets us create speech, modules that let us understand language, modules that help us to detect cheaters in social situations, modules that determine how we treat and relate to members of the opposite sex, modules that cause us to not strangle our children when they get too annoying and rather nurture them instead, and so on. And these are all shaped by the Pleistocene. And of course, they're shaped differently for men and for women, according to this basic idea. So it's kind of genetically programmed, yet it's adaptable enough that you can actually function in a wide range of different environments with these genetic. That's the basic theory.
Well, that sounds fairly straightforward.
In fact, it's quite believable sounding. It sounds like a good set of ideas.
But you say there are problems.
Well, there are problems with it. For one thing, the Pleistocene is 2 million years long, but it is a period of time that has had more variation from time to time than any other geological time period in several tens of millions of years. So the Holocene, this post-Pleistocene era, during this latest time period in human history, many humans lived in societies in which they had adapted to the local environment by inventing agriculture, which buffers environmental change. And the Holocene is relatively less variable from decade to decade. So for several thousand years, we've been living in a relatively stable environment, buffered from changes in that environment, compared to the Pleistocene when things were dramatically variable and human populations around the globe, we now know archaeologically, were vanishing and repopulating and vanishing and repopulating and moving. To the extent, for example, it is now understood that Europeans, for instance, are simply unrelated in any direct way to any of their Cro-Magnon or even more recent ancestors. Europe was depopulated and repopulated multiple times. The Stone Age was not a period of stable, unchanging conditions at all. And actually, I'm the guy who would always go to the evolutionary biology meetings and make the complaint I just made about their use of the Pleistocene. And the response to that was always, well, what we mean is a social environment. We mean men and women living in groups of 30 people with raising their children, and there's lions watching you from the distance, and you're foraging, and so on. We also know that foragers have vastly different social environments. One of the most important things you need to deal with as a male human is your investment in offspring. And because males don't personally give birth, they're never quite sure who they're the father of. They have to be careful how they invest in an offspring. That's true for mammals in general. And there are human groups that live as hunter-gatherers in rainforest environments, living off the land, eating small mammals, fruits from trees and yams and so on, who have vastly different attitudes and approaches towards that basic question. Some societies where pretty much if everyone believes that a certain child is the offspring of a certain man, that's probably true, and other societies where nobody really cares or keeps track. That's a vastly different social behavior. There's no way that an environment in which we evolved that's like that has provided consistent selective forces for how the brain parts that deal with relationships would develop. And there's myriad examples of diversity in hunter-gatherer life ways that tell us that you're not going to find that consistent of an environment. When this kind of thing has been brought up with evolutionary psychologists, the answer is, well, there's still things that are consistent. There's still predators. You still have to eat. Fine. Now we're talking about the evolutionary environment of living things, of amoebas, animals, plants, everything has to get energy and is going to be eaten by somebody. So it's no longer informative at that point. I'll just mention another thing that I think is kind of recent that I find very annoying. When I've gone back to the evolution of psychology literature published in the last 5 or 6 years, there's a new trend of describing foragers in their Pleistocene past as having high rates of violence. I worked with a group of foragers for several years, lived with them for about 3 years. And our study consisted of 200 approximately foragers. And over the first few years of this study, there wasn't a single recorded homicide. And then there was a homicide, which made that group of 200 people the most homicide happy people in the world. The murder rate, when you have one murder among a group of people with 200
right.
people, it goes way through the roof. They became the highest rate of homicide in the world. And then every year since then, there's not been another homicide. So the rates go down, down, down. The same is true with other hunter-gatherer studies. No hunter-gatherer study has ever provided sufficient information to indicate violence rates. And we know from direct experience that tropical hunter-gatherers or foragers have ways of dealing with conflict that don't generally lead to violence. And they're probably not violent people. When I started reading about the assumption that our Pleistocene past was violent, I looked into it and realized that modern evolutionary psychologists have started to add groups of people to their list of hunter-gatherers who aren't. There are groups of people that ethnographically have been documented living traditional ways, growing food as horticulturalists, who have very high rates of violence in New Guinea, in the Amazon, various other places. The highest rates of violence are among the Mayenga in New Guinea or among the Yanomamo of the Amazon, people that have highly vulnerable, extremely important resources that your enemy can easily destroy or steal or take away from you because you planted crops. And in those social environments, you tend to get high levels of militarism or bellicosity, and people are warriors. And you advance to a position of status because you have killed people. And that's not hunter-gatherers. They're not hunter-gatherers. That's not what hunter-gatherers do. But somehow, evolutionary psychologists have lately added those groups of people into those historic roles, in a sense, adulterating the hunter-gatherer sample and making it really kind of useless, adding diversity that might have been there. They may have been violent, warlike hunter-gatherer groups in the past somewhere, but we can't just make that up post hoc.
Would these groups, though, be considered outliers, or does this throw the entire theory out?
They're not outliers. I think human beings will adapt to their habitats. Let me reframe this in terms of gender roles. If you look around the world at cultures where people's economy and way of life have been fairly stable for a few generations or several generations, and people are settled into a certain way of doing things, you'll always see that there are gender roles played by men being men and women being women. If you look across cultures, you will see that they vary dramatically. The men in one culture are way different from the men of a different culture. And if you look at women, you'll see the same thing, a wide degree of variation from culture to culture, to the extent that you can find a culture in which the men are more nurturing, less violent, more child-oriented, etc., than the women of some other culture. But when you look within a culture, you usually find men and women are roughly relate to each other in about the same way, where the relative degree of violence or bellicosity is higher for men and lower for women. And in most societies, men always do the hunting, and sometimes women also hunt. There's not been a society discovered that is a traditional society in the ethnographic database in which women are not the primary cooks. So there's definitely gender roles that are sort of universal, but they kind of make sense. Males and females are different in that females have the babies and the men don't. In order to have control over their futures, they are kind of desperately in need of controlling women's reproductive outputs. So as soon as there's any possible power differential between the men and women, a sort of conspiracy emerges in which the men start to apply that, whatever powers they have, to control those things. How that develops depends on the society, and many different kinds of things can happen. And the role of which women versus men play in society, it's so different that if you are familiar with one or two societies, you can't really predict what some other society is going to be like. Yet there are some consistencies and some similarities. The idea that there's a genetically programmed brain part that makes girls bad at math and boys good at video games and girls good at vocabulary and linguistic things and so on because of this evolutionary past requires that those different cultures are also genetically different. When you compare the Yanomamo, when a man who has killed other men is more likely to have two or three wives, to an F.A. pygmy group where men are not expected to be violent to other humans ever, they must have different genes. But they don't, because we know that we can observe a culture of hunter-gatherers transform into a culture of horticulturalists and become violent. For every three or four cases of stable, long-term, traditional life ways in an ethnographic group, we have an example of a group of people that were observed by missionaries or anthropologists changing over time. And we see dramatic changes in the way that people in those cultures act, the way male and female roles act. Men and women might act differently, but it's something that they get as they develop as individuals. It's a difference that emerges because of the culture and society that you're part of. Culture provides an awful lot more information than genetics when it comes to behavior and when it comes to how the brain operates. And I don't know why we would look to genes for these variations. Now, that does not mean there isn't something there. As boys and girls go through sexual maturity, their brains are bathed in different amounts and kinds of dangerous hormones. My favorite example is the fact that you have very, very few simultaneous translators that are male, because the ability to do that appears to be mostly found in females. Simultaneous translators actually hear in one language and then speak in a different language because they've got two language systems going in their brain at once. And one of them is doing the listening and one of them is doing the talking. And typically they are using one side of their brain to hear and one side of their brain to produce. And that's probably something that probably relates to the fact that women's hemispheres, brains, are more attached. There's more neurons connecting the two sides typically. This actually is a great example of how the gender role research works. There's a phrase called lateralization. Human brains are considered to be special because they're lateralized, meaning one side of the brain does one thing and the other side of the brain does something else. What this really means is one side of the brain isn't broken and the other side of the brain is. And men are more lateralized. And this is something that probably emerges with puberty, and it probably has to do with effects on brain cells, probably caused by estrogen, which is what the testosterone is converted into when it gets into brain cells and selectively kills off cells as part of the sexual maturation of the brain. Male and female humans are not that different when they're born. And as they grow, it's really hard to say whether they become different from each other because we treat them differently or because they are different in some way. On the other hand, you can see male-female differences in young kids that may or may not be caused by these kind of cultural things. But our culture has received the knowledge from our ancestors, from our Victorian ancestors, from our Freudian ancestors, from our 1970s psychology ancestors, that there are strong male-female differences that are genetically programmed. So when we see a difference, we just make that assumption and don't ask what really causes difference to happen. And then, of course, boys and girls grow more different from each other over time. And when they reach sexual maturity, the reason in the United States, anyway, I don't know if you have this in Canada, we have a thing called middle school. It's like purgatory. It's like 2 or 3 year period in which you put all the kids and then they don't even try anything. And then when they're done, they go to high school. And it's during that period of time that they become different creatures. And they do that because they're together. They're differentiating themselves. The boys are being boys and girls are being girls. Anybody who's not a heterosexual boy or girl, that's when they have the biggest difficulties. You know, it's obvious, we can see it. I don't think we're seeing proteins being coded for by genes that are being expressed that result in what happens during that period of sexual maturation.
So just to be clear, though, you aren't necessarily saying that this is false, this theory, just that there's no real evidence to support it.
Actually, the evolutionary psychology theory with its various hypotheses is a very good theory because it is pretty testable. I think that our brains probably do have the modules that they talk about, but I think that the evidence that those modules are coded for by genes is absolutely non-existent. I think those modules emerge because of behavior and learning and culture. That's a better explanation. As to how different males and females would be if you tried everything you could to make them the same, I think you'd get differences. But I think that the list of differences you would end up with would look very different from the list that our culture tends to assume is there about math, spatial abilities, all those things you hear about. Those are things that differentiate in test results. They're real, but they got there because we put them there. And they may not be related to what would normally happen developmentally, and therefore they're certainly not related to what happened in the Pleistocene.
Greg, as always, wonderful to have you on the show.
Well, it's always fun to do it.
You can read more about this falsehood, other falsehoods, evolutionary biology, and other random but interesting science at scienceblogs.com/Greg Layden. And we'll be right back with more Skeptically Speaking.
Skeptically Speaking wants you to question everything. You can email your questions for next week's episode to live@skepticallyspeaking.com, or if you're on Twitter, we're at Skeptical Radio, or use our handy question submission box on the website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also subscribe to the show in iTunes or listen to past episodes, and while you're there, why not add your review? Skeptically Speaking is rebroadcast on a number of fine radio stations. Check the media page at skepticallyspeaking.com to see if we air near you. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell.
I'm here today with Dr. Cordelia Fine. Cordelia is an academic psychologist who studied experimental psychology at Oxford University, followed by a master's of philosophy in criminology at Cambridge, then a PhD in psychology from University College London. She's the author of A Mind of Its Own, How Your Brain Distorts and Deceives, and Delusions of Gender, How Our Minds, Society, and Neurosexism Create Difference. Welcome to the show, Cordelia.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So before we get into modern-day research, you say that scientists have actually been getting this wrong for years. So can you tell us about some of the testing methods that turned out to have nothing to do with behavioral or cognitive differences between the genders?
Yes, well, there are lots of wonderful examples of this, and it was interesting researching this topic because I approached it with a sort of, you know, pull up the sleeves, let's sort this out kind of attitude, and it was only later that, as I came to look at some of the history of this topic, that really this is just something that's been going on for a very long time. So, you know, people like me have been making similar kind of criticisms in the past, sometimes even identical criticisms. And, you know, in 50 years' time, someone also a bit like me is going to write a very similar book, but it's probably going to be, you know, replacing the current, you know, the current brain science, you know, with a critique of the future brain science. So I came to realize, and it was quite depressing in a way, that this is really just part of, you know, a very long history of brain science being used, really to reinforce sort of gender roles and to hinder sex equality, not intentionally by any means, but in the way that our assumptions and the way that our sort of, the way that we're sort of grounded in the way our society currently is kind of blinds us to the possibility of things being differently. And I think the conversation that you had with Greg really highlighted the way that, you know, once you start to look around at other societies other than your own, you start to see where your assumptions begin to fall down. And that's certainly the case in gender research. It's very much based on the ideas are very much based on stereotypes of, you know, white, heterosexual, middle-class Westerners. And again, once you start to look beyond that rarefied group, you start to see that the assumptions that you make aren't necessarily borne out. But to get back to your question about the history, well, I mean, there are lots of examples. So there was a sort of early French philosopher, a contemporary of Descartes, who suggested that women's brain fibers were too delicate to deal with abstract thought. And that's why they weren't as good at thinking as men were. One of my favourite examples is actually the period in time when brain scientists hadn't actually got into the brain as such. They were still dealing with the outer casing, and they were quite keen on the idea that the ratio of skull breadth to skull height was a good indicator of mental capacity. So they'd go around sort of wrapping tape measures around people's heads and working out the ratio. And so you're either sort of broad-headed or long-headed. And they were very, very interested in whether this could distinguish superior groups, you know, namely white European males, from intellectually inferior groups, so, you know, people who weren't white and weren't male. And I think what's interesting about this example is the sort of theoretical contortions they had to go through to sort of, or attempted to make in order to try and keep women in the inferior group. So as the data came in, they weren't really very neat. They didn't quite fit the hypothesis. And so one of the advocates of this you know, measure of index of mental capacity, Paul Popenard, he suggested, well, perhaps women are more broad-headed in the long-headed groups, more long-headed in the broad-headed groups. You know, he couldn't. he wanted them to be different. And, you know, in the end, of course, that was abandoned. The idea that your skull shape was an indicator of mental capacity was also abandoned, and, you know, it became more sophisticated. So then people started sort of weighing scales, so it actually got into the brain itself, and that was more sophisticated. And then, of course, the hypothesis was, as is true, that the female brain on average is smaller and lighter than the male brain. And it was very much sort of mainstream scientific opinion that this explained women's intellectual inferiority. And so this was known amongst the Victorian public as the missing 5 ounces of female brain.
Ah.
And which was charming. And, you know, eventually it became evident that there wasn't this neat, bigger is better correlation when it came to brain size and intelligence. And the historian of science, Cynthia Russett, describes very, very dryly and amusingly the way he thought, well, you know, people said, well, look, maybe it's just that, you know, bigger body, bigger brain, it's just part of the body relationship. So they tried to find a relative measure of brain size that would keep men ahead. they tried everything, you know, sort of weight and height, and you know, even trying to relate it to someone bone like the femur or something, in a desperate attempt to make men come out ahead. And you know, again, this hypothesis was eventually abandoned. But of course, there are always more to spring up and take their place. And those are the sorts of hypotheses that I look at in my book.
The current studies that you do talk about in the book are often based on the fMRI tests. So maybe could you first explain how the testing works?
Yes. So now, of course, we have unprecedented access into the actual working of the brain. Although it's important to say that fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, doesn't give you direct access to actual neural activity. So some people will look at those colourful pictures of brain scans and assume that that's sort of a snapshot of the brain at work. That's actually not the case, in a sense. To people who don't have a background in the area, the images are actually a little bit misleading. So if you look at these colourful spots that you see on these brain scan images, they're not showing brain activity, they're showing statistical significance. So what happens in these studies is you'll be brought in, you'll be given some kind of experimental task to do, and through very complicated means, an indirect measure of neural activity is taken. So that sort of relies on the fact that more active parts of the brain have greater blood flow, so there are ways of sort of indexing blood flow. So it's an indirect measure of neural activity. And then what you have is a control task that, as much as possible, involves very much the same kinds of things that you're doing in the thing that you're really interested in, like, so you're pressing buttons and you need to make sure then your control task, you're also pressing buttons, so that you're not just looking at the pressing buttons part of the brain, but you try and sort of isolate the thing that you're interested in, and then you compare the indirect measure of brain activity for those two things, and then you sort of make some sort of you compare activity in all the different parts of the brain, and you test for statistical significance in your experimental and your control task, and that's where you get your little patches of colour. So if there's statistical significance, then that's where you get your, you know, your little red blob or whatever. So that's how those neuroimaging studies work. It's a very simplified description, but that's the basic idea. And so one of the most intensively researched hypotheses, and actually something that Greg talked on, and I found what he said absolutely fascinating. This is one point where I would disagree with what he said. So as he talked about, there's this very pervasive idea that the male brain is more lateralized than the female brain, so that it tends to be more specialized in the way that the brain works. So it tends to use tends to just use the left hemisphere for language, tends to just use the right hemisphere for visuospatial functioning, for example. So before the days of neuroimaging, people used to look at this in a different way. They used to do something called a dichotic listening task, where you feed words into the left ear or the right ear, and because that information is processed in the other hemisphere of the brain, that's one way of sort of indexing to what extent the person's sort of tending to use one or both hemispheres for processing language. But with the advent of neuroimaging, people decided to use this technology as a way of investigating this hypothesis. And I think this is a really good example of how these ideas about differences in male and female brains, how the way that the sort of facts about differences between the brains are produced and then interpreted and then feed out into the popular literature is quite problematic. So one very well-known, very influential neuroimaging study of language processing in the brain was done by Shaywitz and colleagues. It was published in 1995 in Nature, and it's had a huge impact. It's been cited approximately 500 times, which is, you know, the sort of thing that every sort of citation impact that, you know, most scientists only dream of. And in this particular study, they had, I believe, 19 men, 19 women, and they had three different kinds of language tasks. Now, in two of the language tasks, they found no sex differences in language lateralization. So men and women were using their brains in the same way according to the neuroimaging data. And the third task, which was phonological processing to do with what words sound like, they did find a sex difference. So they found that, you know, in accordance with this sort of even by then quite long-standing idea, they found that men tend to show just left-sided activity for in the sort of language-related areas of the brain, whereas women showed bilateral activity. Now, as I said, this study has been cited numerous times, and it really sort of fueled this idea of the more specialized male brain. But the problem is that there's a real issue in sex differences research generally, and especially so with neuroimaging data, with spurious results. So you can imagine that if you're interested in a particular area of cognition, and you know you tend to use male and female participants, you tend not to have a huge number of people because neuroimaging is just very expensive. You don't tend to have huge sample sizes, particularly earlier on in when this research started. And you can imagine that if you just test by sex differences by default, which does seem to be something that happens, and you don't find any differences, well, you don't report it because you've got a small number of men and women. Wasn't there something you're necessarily looking for? So you don't really make any mention of it. But if you do find a difference, then that can actually often become the main focus of the article and receive a lot of attention. And you can see that, of course, because of the way that statistical testing works, you know, if 19 people don't find a difference and don't report it, but the one spurious finding of a difference gets a bit of a song and a dance around it, then you've got a problem, because the research field in general is going to have a bias towards findings of sex difference and away from findings of sex similarity. Now, this is a problem that's been acknowledged for a long time in sex differences research, you know, to do with, you know, behavioral differences, nothing to do with the brain. But there may be reasons that it might be a particular problem in neuroimaging research. So one is, as I mentioned, often have quite small sample sizes. So, for example, when I was investigating popular claims of sex differences, I would go back to the original sources and look at the studies that they were citing as evidence of, you know, different male and female brains. I would find studies which did indeed find sex differences. They tended to find a lot of sex similarity, but then focus on, you know, some sort of often almost marginal difference. And you'd have a very small sample. You might have 6 men or 6 women or 10 or 12. You know, we're talking about very small numbers here. And because of the variability of neuroimaging data, there are sort of teething problems. There are nuisance variables like breathing rate and caffeine intake that can increase the variability and make these data sort of somewhat unreliable, particularly with these small sample sizes. And the other thing I would say is that there with these sort of relatively new neuroimaging technologies, there are quite a lot of controversies in the scientific community about how to best analyze the data. What should our thresholds of significance be? Are we letting too many spurious findings through the net, both in relation to sex differences and generally when you're looking for significant activation differences? So, you know, these are just teething problems. They're perfectly natural, but we need to be worried about them if they're sort of creating spurious sex difference findings that are then being made much of, for example, in the popular literature. So to come back to the language lateralization study, there in fact, you know, many such studies have now been done, and when you look at them as a whole, what you see, and this has been done in a meta-analysis by Iris Summer, so a meta-analysis is where you take all the studies that have looked at a particular question and you pool them together, and you and also you weight them according to the size of the sample, so you know you're not taking too much account of these sort of smaller, less reliable studies. And Iris Sommer and her colleagues have actually done this twice. They did it, published meta-analyses in 2004 and 2008. And in both cases, they found that overall, there is no significant sex difference in language lateralization, either with neuroimaging findings or, in fact, from the older way of looking for it, the dichotic listening tasks. And actually, it's interesting because when you look at their results, you see there's this huge variability, especially with these smaller studies. They're sort of out on the extremes, but these larger studies sort of center in towards zero, no difference, and of course the overall effect is on no significant difference. So this is really an example of where you can have a small study, the results of which do not appear to be reliable, having a huge impact, actually not just within the popular media, but also within the scientific community itself. And part of this is to do with the fact that you have default testing for sex differences and also a tolerance for the reporting of sex differences based on quite small sample sizes, which, you know, I'm not saying that shouldn't be done, but I think it's certainly a topic that needs to be discussed within the neuroscientific community because it appears to be creating problems down the line.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and I'm on the line with Dr. Cordelia Fine. We're discussing her new book, Delusions of Gender, How Our Minds, Society, and Neurosexism Create Difference. If you have a question, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. Cordelia, one of the things you did in your book was completely tear apart Luann Brissendine's book, The Female Brain. So let's look at just one of those claims, that the female brain is wired to empathize. So how did she come to that conclusion?
I think part of the route that she took to that conclusion, partly to present evidence that behaviorally women are superior in empathizing, but then she also looked at neuroimaging data as well. So I'll probably briefly talk about the behavioral evidence for this idea that women are better at inferring people's thoughts and feelings. And it is quite comical reading Luann Brissendine's book because she does paint an incredible picture of women's empathizing abilities. I mean, apparently we're actually supposed to know what men are thinking before they even know themselves, which
is setting
the bar pretty high, I think. And there's also, when she talks about the female brain being hardwired to sort of monitor the thoughts and feelings of other people, I mean, she's not saying explicitly, but she's very much saying that women, it is your job to take care of other people's feelings and be concerned about them and be the one who notices when someone's upset and so on and so forth. So, you know, there's a definite sort of political element to this claim as well. And unfortunately for Brissendine, it's not really supported by the data, either sort of behavioral data or, you know, are women actually better at empathizing, or certainly not by the neuroimaging data that she cites. So,
well, I do want to point out that you actually analyzed every single neuroscience study that she cited as proof of female superiority in that area, and you did not exactly find compelling evidence.
No, that's right. I went through, she has a chapter called Emotional Brain or something like that, a chapter on emotion, and I did look at all the neuroimaging data that she cited as support for that, and to give it an indication to readers of how inaccurate her use of the scientific literature is, I go through a couple of pages of her book, and how shall I put this? It doesn't fulfill the standards of scientific accuracy in representation of data that one would hope from someone with her kinds of qualifications. So, for example, some of the studies that she cites as evidence for women's sort of more empathic or sympathetic responses to other people's pain, she draws on a neuroimaging study of people who they compared neural activity when someone was either given an electric shock to their hand or they saw their partner having an electric shock applied to their hand. But unfortunately, that particular study only used female participants. Now, clearly, you can't make any
interesting
claim about differences between male and female brains on the basis of a neuroimaging study that only investigated brain activity in female brains. Now, there was that same group did do another similar study where they did include male participants, and that time they found a small sex difference in that this time it wasn't a partner, it was a confederate, and the confederates had either behaved in a sort of likable or dislikable way. And they found male and female brain activity was similar so long as the confederate had been likable, but different in the male, apparently a less supposed sympathetic response when the confederate had behaved in a dislikable way. But there's a sort of carelessness to how the, I think that would be a generous way of describing it, to how Luann Brissendine uses the data that I think actually reflects in a more general way on our casualness about this topic, because the sorts of claims that Lynne Brizendine has made, you know, certainly in relation to her book The Female Brain, has often been sort of uncritically reproduced or represented in newspapers and so on. And I think if people were making similar kinds of claims about differences between, you know, black and white brains, for example, people might, you know, journalists might feel, oh, gosh, let's just fact-check this before we send it out. And that doesn't happen when it comes to claims about differences between male and female brains. You see claims that often come from popular books, popular writers, that are simply incorrect, but they're in there in the press, and nobody seems that worried about this kind of misinformation going out there.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're discussing the new book, Delusions of Gender, with author Cordelia Fine. If you have a question, email us at live@skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back after this message.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we talk to Dr. David Gorski, surgical oncologist and editor at the website Science-Based Medicine, about the science and the suspicion of vaccinations. How do vaccines actually work? Why do so many parents fear them? And how has vaccine anxiety contributed to the resurgence of childhood diseases? On Speaking Up, Laird Shaka talks about the Vaccine Times, his project targeting pediatricians' waiting rooms in the fight against vaccine misinformation. That's next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 Mountain Time, live at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell. Today we're talking about the assumption that gender roles are hardwired. Our guest is Dr. Cordelia Fine, author of Delusions of Gender, How Our Minds, Society, and Neurosexism Create Difference. And we have a question from the chat room.
Is there any way at all that men are more X and women are more Y? Or do the bell curves just overlap too much for it to be statistically significant? And that's from Bytor.
Well, that raises a very important point about how we tend to think about sex differences, which is something that psychologists in this area just, I think they just feel like they want to die of boredom because they say it over and over again, you know, which is that variability within sex is much greater than differences between sexes. And of course, often there are assumed to be differences between the sexes that in fact either don't exist or are actually surprisingly sensitive to the context in which something has been done. But just to touch on that point again of the overlapping curves, I think that's a really important point, because I think the way we talk about gender differences, and in particular talking about boy brains and girl brains, in a sense, I don't think there's anyone on the planet who doesn't realize or hasn't noticed the extraordinary variability of humans and what they are and what they can do, and nobody thinks that all boys are like this and all girls are like this, or recognize in some sense that of course there are overlaps in abilities and predispositions and personalities and so on and so forth. But when you start talking about boy brains and girl brains, it very much primes people to see males and females and categorize them in this very kind of crude caricature of maleness and femaleness. And I've recently moved to the Melbourne Business School, and of course a lot of the interest there is on this idea that what can women leaders bring to business, and there's this real push to draw on pseudoscience basically to say, well look, women have these special abilities because of these differences in their brains, and they can, you know, they bring a broader brush scope, for example, they're not so tied down, they're more intuitive, they have these benefits, so on and so forth. Now, apart from the fact that neuroscience doesn't show the brain differences that are claimed, and also even if they did, we have actually no scientific reason to think that they would be related to a different way of thinking in males and females. So, you know, scientifically, this is just nonsense. But I think it very much encourages people in business to see, well, women leaders are like this and male leaders are like this. And it actually discourages people from seeing leaders as leaders with their own particular very idiosyncratic strengths and weaknesses that are actually very poorly predicted by the sex that the person happens to be. So I think this notion of overlapping bell curves is absolutely extremely important. But at the same time, I think it's even that doesn't go quite far enough. So if you to come back to the point about Lynne Brizendine, her claim is that women are more empathic, and people just believe that this is fact. And it's true that if you ask women, well, how good are you at working out what someone's feeling or thinking, then yes, they will come out ahead on those self-report questionnaires. But it turns out that how good people think they are at inferring other people's thoughts and feelings bears little or no relationship to how good they actually are. So you have this whole group of people who think they're, you know, superbly socially sensitive, and they go through life sort of trampling on people's feelings and not realizing what they're actually thinking. And so when you give men and women an actual performance test of empathic ability, so you put them in a room with someone, they don't realize it, but they're being secretly recorded, and then afterwards they're shown the videotape and they're asked, well, what was the person thinking there? What were they thinking there? What were they thinking there? You actually find that men and women perform identically on this test. It's been shown in numerous studies. The exception being that if you somehow highlight the social norm that women should be more sensitive, and then women do indeed perform a bit better, but that seems to be because they feel a kind of motivation because of this social norm to perform a bit better. So as well as sort of acknowledging the massive overlap between males and females, we also need to be careful about not assuming that perhaps that difference that you assume is there may not actually be present when you test for it properly.
We have another question from the website.
How might your research apply to current understandings of gender identity disorder as described in the DSM-4 and to the support of transgender individuals in clinical practice and in the world in general? And that's from Dana Blumrosen.
Much as I hate to say that something in my book doesn't bear on a particular issue, I will have to say that what I talk about in the book and what I focus on specifically is this very popular, influential idea that because of different levels of fetal testosterone, this hardwires either a male brain that's predisposed to understand the world, be interested in objects and how they work, to systemize, as Simon Baron Cohen calls it, versus a female brain which is hardwired to empathize, to understand and respond to other people. And I really focused on this question because to me it's just a very long-standing idea that basically offers justification for a gender status quo in which caring, paid and unpaid, falls primarily on women, and men are overrepresented in domains like science, politics, technology, business, law, etc., particularly at the higher levels. So that was the focus in my book. But this idea that fetal testosterone sort of organizes a male or female brain is indeed part of a sort of whole package that also sort of throws in sexuality and core gender identity, so this sense of being male or female. Now, I quickly came to realize that those data were perhaps much more complicated than is often assumed by the public and popular literature, and it wasn't my main focus, so I don't address that in my book. But for those people who are interested in those issues, I would strongly recommend another new book that came out within the week of mine by Rebecca Jordan Young called Brainstorm, The Flaws in Sex Differences Research. So she looks in very careful, meticulous detail at this whole package of brain organization theory. So I would, for those who are interested in those topics, in particular sexuality, I would recommend that book.
You're listening to Skeptically Speaking, and we're talking with author Cordelia Fine about delusions of gender. Email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. So we've sort of started to talk about the social consequences of this kind of shoddy research, let's say. The differences between male and female brains was used historically to highlight that inferiority, that supposed inferiority. Specifically, it was used to restrict women's right to vote, correct?
Yes, it's one of my favorite historical examples. An opinion piece in the New York Times, which was published in 1915, and a rather eminent neurologist called Dr. Charles Dana was very kindly offered his professional opinion on the wisdom of women's suffrage. And what he does is he describes in, you know, very admirable detail differences in the sizes of the brainstem and the different parts of the spinal cord in men and women. And, you know, so for example, the part of the spinal cord that sends messages to the limbs and the pelvis, he said, you know, that's larger in women. And he says, you know, and I think the key to understanding this chain of thought here might lie in the word pelvis. He says, you know, I think these differences indicate that women's special efficiency might not lie in politics. Basically, women's brains aren't designed for politics. Mm-hmm. They're designed to be at home and to be mothers. Now, of course, we can look back on this, you know, the spinal cord and the brainstem, I mean, you know, beyond keeping you breathing as you approach the ballot box, we can probably see that there's nothing particularly critical about these parts of the brain in terms of political behavior. But, you know, at the time it seemed sufficiently plausible to be published in the New York Times. But I think what I find interesting about this example is that it's sort of very admirably, cautiously expressed. You say, you know, I don't say that these differences will prevent women from voting. But I have to say, it does go on to say that, you know, if they do, then they will suffer 25% more insanity than they had at the time. But, you know, it's very cautious. They say, you know, let's look at these brain data and consider what they might mean. And it's interesting because you see that very same kind of tentativeness in contemporary opinion pieces on this topic in the New York Times. So, for example, you'll have Simon Baron Cohen talking about how, you know, well, there are, you know, differences in this part of the brain and that part of the brain and so on and so forth. And you say, you know, quite how they might affect these things is not quite clear. But, you know, he's introducing this topic in the context of female underrepresentation in science. And so, of course, you know, the understanding is, well, you know, there are differences in the brain. They must be significant. And so I do think it's interesting because when you actually look very closely at sex differences in the brain, what you find is that there are remarkably few sex differences that are reliable and well-established, and none that have been related to sex differences in cognition, and certainly none that have been related to sex differences in scientific ability. So I do suspect that in 100 years' time, people will look back on the 2005 New York Times opinion piece, you know, with the same kind of shocked amusement that we look back on the 1915 one that is talking about the role of the brainstem in political behavior.
So, in the meantime, does all of this just give us excuses, really? Women are bad at math, men are bad at emotional issues, that kind of thing, sort of a widespread, don't worry, it's not your fault. Are we justifying our own failures through science?
I think there's definitely an appeal to this idea that sex inequality is hardwired, that it's something inevitable and immutable about it. And I find it interesting because I didn't come to this book with a very skeptical view of the science. I really, my initial trigger for writing this book was looking at the popular literature and being aghast by how the neuroscientific data were being mangled by popular writers. And what I saw was writers taking these sort of very small findings from small studies and using gender stereotypes to build very long bridges from those to sort of educational strategies or relationship strategies. And I was just appalled by this, and that was the trigger to write the book. But when I actually came to look at the scientific data itself, I was surprised at the assumptions that were being made and the many, many issues and the methodologies and the prematurity of the conclusions that were being drawn and so on and so forth. So I didn't come into this research for this book, you know, realizing the sort of skeptical nature of the conclusions that I would end up with. But nonetheless, I'm sort of accused of being somebody, it's sort of assumed that I just have this ideology where I just want to ignore the science because I would prefer to think that males and females are identical in every way. But I actually think there's a good argument for saying that it's more comfortable to believe the opposite. I think it's more comfortable to think, gosh, well, you know, yes, we still have a great deal of gender inequality in the world, but, you know, it's not just simply unfair. It's not because of sex
right.
discrimination or the second shift or something as boring as who does the laundry. It's because of, you know, fetal testosterone and things are the way that they should be. You know, psychologists have identified that we have something called the system justification motive. So we do have an urge to want to see the way things are as somehow fair and natural and inevitable, and that applies to people who are sort of given the rawest deal out of the status quo as much as people who are doing rather well out of it. So I think these kinds of accounts of hardwired sex differences do kind of let us off the hook. They say, oh, we don't need to worry about trying to chivvy more girls into science and maths anymore, and we don't need to chivvy our husbands into helping out more at home and so on and so forth. And I say this not trying to make people feel guilty or parents feel guilty or anything like that, but I think they do sort of let us sort of collectively as a society off the hook a bit.
So when we do hear about some new study that tells us that boys are innately like this and girls are innately like that, what are some things that lay people can look for that would tell us that maybe we should be skeptical?
Well, if you're talking about a neuroimaging study, a really important point to remember is that a lot of these findings will never be replicated, especially if they're based on small samples. But, you know, generally there is variability in these data. And what you can be sure of is that when the study isn't replicated, you will not read about it in the newspaper. I personally think it would be wonderful if meta-analyses were given more press attention in the science media. I think it's really interesting that individually, studies can show that males are more lateralized for language, but that overall the consistent picture is no, actually there is no sex difference in how the brain is organized for those things. So one thing for people to bear in mind is one-off study, it may not be replicated. I mean, science is probabilistic. A second point is that in the brain doesn't mean innate. So our brains develop in constant interaction with our environments. There isn't just some sort of genetic blueprint that just then gets built on through some pre-specified code. So just because you see a sex difference in the brain doesn't mean that it must be hardwired. It could be, you know, where else would the effects of gender socialization manifest themselves? But the third point is really, we're so early on in our journey of understanding how neural circuits enable complex psychological phenomena that we don't really know at this point. When we have a neuroimaging finding or pattern of brain activity or a structural difference, what does that mean for cognition? It actually might, one possibility that rarely gets considered is that it might not mean anything. You know, the brain has more than one means, there's more than one road to Rome. But we also, we need to be very cautious about making assumptions about what they might mean. You know, even if women were less lateralized for language, would that mean that they were better at language? Well, people have assumed that for decades. No one's actually tested the idea. So we need to be very careful. As Anne Fausto-Sterling pointed out, the brain is a vast unknown, and because it's so complex, it's very easy for us to sort of project our assumptions about gender onto these very complex, ambiguous data. And we just need to look to the past to see how dangerous that can be and how harmful for progress towards sex equality, because these ideas about male and female brains are very much part of the cultural law, and they interact with our minds. They reinforce stereotypes, and they create self-fulfilling prophecies.
And we are out of time. Thank you so much for being here, Cordelia.
Thank you for having me on the show.
You can find out more about Cordelia at cordeliafine.com, and you can find out more about us at skepticallyspeaking.com. Click the links to Facebook, to Twitter, and to iTunes, where you can listen to past episodes or subscribe to the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking. Hello, all. You may have heard me mention that we're coming up on our lovely host station's annual fundraising campaign, Fundrive, which runs from October 27th to November 6th. Skeptically Speaking will air twice during the campaign, and that gives me two opportunities to enthusiastically ask for your support for this fine radio station. One of those episodes will be a retrospective. We'll take a look back through our past episodes and revisit some of the most interesting, entertaining, and amusing segments that we've recorded with our guests. Any episode, any guest in our catalog is fair game, and you can help us choose. If you've ever wanted to play producer, now's your chance. We've received some brilliant emails about your favorite show moments, so do keep them coming. You can send your ideas to feedback@skepticallyspeaking.com. In addition to airing those best bits, we have so much more in store for you. We have fantastic prizes we'll be giving away on air, some of them donated by past guests to the show. We have a veritable multimedia extravaganza in the works, and we'll have many, many ways that you can show your love for science and critical thought by giving us money. We'll tell you all about what to expect on upcoming episodes. Until then, do keep in mind that on Skeptically Speaking, we interview researchers, authors, and experts to help you understand the evidence, arguments, and science behind what's in the news and on the shelves. You may not realize it, but some people are adamantly opposed to some of the subjects that we cover on the show. Topics like vaccination, genomics, nuclear power, and evolution. Even conversations about race and gender. This is all content that some people find very controversial. And that means that the subjects desperately need to be discussed rationally, realistically, and reasonably. And you can contribute to maintaining that dialogue by donating. In the meantime, thanks so much for your support. And stay tuned to Skeptically Speaking.
Bring it on. The skeptics await your letter. Your call, tweet, homing, pigeon, whatever. Desert.
X-ray shell. Gonna raise a little hell. Break the spell of Pavlov's bells. Cause we're skeptically speaking. Online reading tarot cards and witches, psychics, and their spoon bending mind tricks. All the humbug, flim flam, frauds and shams, the charlatan who I don't think you understand. It's the hocus pocus, out of focus, locus, eroding the brain, making gains on the hopeless. Let the crystal ball fall, smash on the floor. Leave the pieces alone, we don't need them anymore. Just a microscope, telescope, magnifier, reading in between the lines of these lies. Bring it on, the skeptics await your letter, your call, tweet, homing pigeon, whatever. Desiree Shell gonna raise a little hell, metaphorically that is, cause we're skeptically speaking.